Thanks to all of you for joining me this afternoon to discuss the coronavirus and what steps you can take to protect you and your family, and steps that federal and state officials are currently taking to keep our community safe. I want to thank Chief Medical and Chief Quality Officer for Berkshire Health, Dr. James Lederer, who is joining us at this moment. He has a strong background in infectious disease medicine, so he can provide the most updated and medically accurate answers to your questions. We're also reminded what a treasure that that Berkshire Medical Center is for all of us in central and western Massachusetts. So first, let me thank the healthcare workers throughout western Massachusetts and central Massachusetts and the rest of the state for their very hard work to help prevent, diagnose, and treat patients impacted by the coronavirus. You are on the front lines, and I know my colleagues in the United States Congress join me in thanking you. As chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, we certainly played a key role in developing the third bipartisan measure to address the coronavirus and to bring stability to our nation's economy and healthcare system. The healthcare workers on the front lines of this crisis are being pushed to their limits both financially and physically. They need more masks, tests, ventilators, and beds to combat the virus. The legislation that we accomplished last Friday morning, I hope, will go a long way towards securing these resources and an additional $100 billion plus for funding our hospitals and our healthcare system in this national emergency. As we face this record economic challenge, families need benefits that will allow them to cover essential expenses like food, rent, and medications. The additional $600 per week in unemployment benefits that we fought for will be included. It's important to remember that that serves two purposes. One, to make sure that people have a cash flow. And secondly, for those at the lower end of the economic scale, a reminder that if they know they're going to have that bridge, then in fact they will be more likely to get tested, because many of those folks, because they can't get paid if they don't go to work for a day, that they will likely return to work even if they might demonstrate some of the symptoms. So we also fought to include provisions that will shore up the financial health of small businesses and other struggling employers. At the state level, I've been in close touch with Governor Baker as we monitor the situation and identify ways to help patients, healthcare workers, and others on the front lines. But more needs to be done. There will likely be a Phase 4 legislative measure. This should be an opportunity for hospitals and other healthcare providers to help get the resources they need to address the crisis. Dr. Lederer will speak more to this, but I wanted to remind everyone to take the common sense steps to help reduce the spread of the virus by washing your hands, avoiding touching your face, and avoiding close contact with people, and just as importantly, staying at home where you can. So I'm going to go back to our moderator, Elizabeth, who will walk us through the final logistics and how you can ask Dr. Lederer or me a question, and then we can get the conversation started.
A reminder for anyone still joining the call, if you'd like to ask a question, you can simply press star 3. Our first question comes from John in Williamstown. John, you're live. Go ahead.
Live now?
John,
okay.
You're with us.
Yeah. Are you with, yeah, all right. I've got a question. When will tests be available? For have I already had the disease? Do I now have the disease? If I've had it and have recovered, or if I have it and do recover, will I remain infectious to others? And four, will I be immune against future reinfection? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Leave that up to Dr. Lederer.
Goodness, that's a complex four parts, so I'm going to try and tackle it as I can. I think let's first talk about what we can do today if we have symptoms, fever, lower respiratory tract symptoms of cough, chest tightness, congestion. That's where the current DNA testing methodologies will be able to determine that you have active virus infection. So for current infection, the current DNA technologies are what we're looking to today to answer that question. In terms of the epidemiologic evaluation long-term or long after the COVID virus is over, that's where some of the state epidemiologists and whether or not we can really widely deploy some of these antibody-based tests. An antibody is what your own body makes in combating a bacteria or a virus. And the presence of those antibodies are typically long-lived, so that were I to draw blood samples on all of Pittsfield, I would know who had the virus and, you know, how many and what populations of patients and all of the information I could glean from the patient and who they were and what their positive or negative result was. So I could get that in-depth information, but it generally is reflective of past long-gone infection. And so it is an epidemiological tool, these antibody tests that are very helpful. They don't necessarily help in the acute because your body has to mount that immune response and make those antibodies, and there could be a delay from anywhere from, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to start to see some of the antibody production. So it doesn't help us real time with active infection, but it helps us in the epidemiological surveillance. The question that's asked about, am I still infectious, that's a hard one for us to answer, and we don't have all that information today. We can find in some patients a good week or two after they are improved, their fever's gone, their symptoms have resolved, the virus particles in their nose. But what we don't know is if those virus particles are actually infectious or are they degraded virus themselves that is still resident there in the nasal passage, but not causing any infection. And so, you know, I think it's that duo of tests, the antibody tests and the DNA tests, that help us both real time today as well as in long term follow up. And then just a recognition that we don't have good information yet on truly when I am well and when I wouldn't be a risk to other people. And how that interacts and interfaces with a test that may be obtained that would show a virus particle present, but we don't know about the infectivity in a person who's well improved and on their way, you know, to being happy and healthy again.
A reminder to those still joining the call, please press *3 to ask a question. Our next caller is John from Pittsfield. John, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you so much. Congressman, it's John Bistola, President of Greylock Federal Credit Union.
Oh, how are you, John? Yeah.
I'm doing well, thank you. We really appreciate your support during this crisis, and it's great to hear Dr. Lederer. I have the privilege of being on the Berkshire Health Systems Board, and any support you can offer to our health system here and everywhere is greatly appreciated. I also want to ask you today about economic development support. Certainly the stimulus bill and the federal relief funds are substantial. We have a concern here locally in our rural economy about the survival of some of our smallest businesses in the interim before that aid arrives. We have stood up a fund at the One Berkshire Foundation and been able to raise some money locally, about $250,000, to provide outreach and grants and technical assistance to some of those firms, but we sure could use a lot more quickly. Again, we're concerned that in the intervening weeks and months before the federal aid really starts to flow, we may lose some of these small businesses that really would prefer to continue to operate. And so anything you could do to help
sure.
us find, you and your team, to find some federal dollars that we could put into that fund and move it out right away would be greatly appreciated.
Sure. So what we did with Secretary Mnuchin, myself, and the Speaker, as we developed our bill, we reached an agreement on the following, that getting cash into the hands of people, we would call them single filers under $75,000 a year, $1,200 was critical. In addition, for joint filers, that would be up to $150,000 a year, and that would be $2,400. In addition, there would be $500 for every child. Again, this was for the infusion of cash to make sure people were able to meet the necessities of daily life. The second part of what we did, the third part of what we did, because the first part I mentioned earlier with more than $100 billion for hospitals and our frontline healthcare workers and families, but the third part of what we did is we devised this plan that would use the intermediary of the community banker or the credit union for getting this money out the door, because we think you know your customers best. The opportunity is here. If employers can keep employees on the payroll, you will be able, for some small businesses, and if you go to my website, neil.house.gov, or to the Ways and Means Committee website, you can see that we are prepared to, through the SBA and the community bankers and credit unions, we are prepared to allow up to $10 million to be backed by the federal government. And if employers are able to keep the employee on through this bad period, this difficult period, there's an excellent chance of forgiveness for that loan going forward. So I think that, again, health care was first, economic security was second, but until we solve the health care problem with coronavirus, it's hard to understand how we can solve the contagion that has made its way into the economic challenge. So those are opportunities, and anything I can do on that to move that money along, I'm available to you. I think it's very important. The other part of this that we undertook for the first time, we are allowing those barbers and nail salon people and others who typically don't qualify for unemployment insurance this time to qualify for it. And in addition to that, we are going to reach not just tax filers, but those who don't make enough money to file income tax returns. So they're included in this package as well. And I can't emphasize enough just how important that is. The other item here I think that's really critical is that coming out of the 2008 crisis, which was largely based on malfeasance of using sophisticated debt instruments that they didn't have any understanding of what they were doing, that what we did this time around, we reminded people that this was not about economic malfeasance, this was not about military action, this was about an international pandemic. So we've expanded the base of making sure that people had access to the flow of dollars. The critical, I think, thought here, once again, is trying to build some confidence and stability in the system, acknowledging that there is likely to be a phase four that we've already been discussing, because if this proceeds through the summer, we're going to have to make sure that those people that I've just described still have access to their lifeline of credit. So we look to people like you because that's a great operation that you have. And again, coming out of 2008, remember that most of our financial institutions, they're in far better shape than they were in 2008, largely because of the new requirements for capital reserves that were authored in the aftermath of 2008. And the banks in particular are in pretty good shape. So anything we can do with the SBA to help move this along, we're using the IRS because they have the available data. For our seniors, we're using the Social Security Administration. And even where it's hard to track people at the bottom, who are not filers, for example, we're going to try hard to use Medicaid records. Because in the state of Massachusetts, for example, because of the notion of universal coverage, there is a Medicaid database that is available to us as well. So very good question, and hang in there.
A reminder for anyone still joining the call, if you'd like to ask a question, you can simply press *3. Our next question comes from Susan from Lanesboro. Susan, you're on the line.
Hi. I don't know how I'm going to word this exactly. I understand at BMC there isn't enough tests for their employees. Some of them have been in contact with people that have been infected, but they themselves can't be tested at this point, even if they have cold symptoms. I'm wondering what the criteria of testing is, not only for them, but for anybody at this point, because there isn't enough test kits, what you are using for the cutoff on who can be tested and who can't.
Yeah, thank you. So let me just to clarify. It is true that nationwide we don't have as many test kits today as we would like to have. And so we've had to use a process and a planning process where those for whom the results would make the most different, and what I mean by that is someone ill admitted to the intensive care unit or to the step-down unit or to the general medicine ward here in this facility or other facilities across the state, knowledge of their positivity or negativity would help drive potentially some of the new therapeutic options that have been developed, but it would also drive, you know, the isolation precaution procedures and the PPE and masking requirements, you know, to make sure that the employees are as protected as they can be. But that said, you know, it is true that some of our employees have either been exposed to patients in the hospital, now possibly even much more likely being exposed to people in the community is what we're seeing with our current employees who are ill, is more of them have no known contact, and that likely it came out of the communities themselves. We do have tests available both for the employees as well as for the community. We are trying to, as I said, look at the greatest good, and so those with fevers and respiratory symptoms, particularly lower respiratory tract symptoms with chest tightness and cough and chest congestion, you know, that person is much more likely to have COVID virus than, say, someone with scratchy eyes and a runny nose, you know, with allergy season just starting up. So we don't have as many tests as we would like. We here at Berkshire Health System probably have about 2 weeks if we just ran full out and didn't get any further replacements. But Quest, the diagnostic lab, is supplying us with a few kits day over day, and so that 20 days could probably be stretched to about 30. What we really would like to see is many more point-of-care tests available, the kind of tests that we would use our machines in our lab to do, which would be a real-time assay that the ER physicians and the hospitalists up on the wards could get their answers in minutes, if not an hour, and would be able to better manage their patients that way. But those haven't yet been fully FDA vetted, nor have the kits been developed and sent out to us. So we're doing what we can in these next few weeks, hoping that these next generation of tests will be more available and we can open up our testing and be more available to our community to answer their, you know, positivity or negativity questions.
A reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you can simply press star 3. Our next caller is Gail from Sheffield. Gail, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. My husband and I are seniors, and I, in good health, I'd like to go out. I mean, I do go out at once a week for grocery shopping to Big Y or Guido's, and I'd like to know, is it advisable to wear a mask?
So, you know, we are encouraging social distancing, and if everyone were to follow that is to say, you know, when I go to the grocery store, I don't necessarily wear a mask, but I do make sure I'm standing 6 to 8 feet behind the person in front of me at the checkout. You know, I don't harbor and you know, linger in a crowded aisle. I usually bring some Sani wipes to wipe down the cart itself, the handle. And so it's those routine measures that we do. You know, I think if you feel comfortable wearing a mask, I don't know that there's a lot of benefit to just that, but, you know, certainly in a more crowded condition, if you're, you know, Guido's is a smaller facility and more people may be there than in, say, a larger chain, you know, I don't think there's any harm in wearing a mask. I just don't know that it's 100% the protection that you wish you had, and then I would look to make sure that I did those other things as well, wiping down the grocery cart, the handle, making sure that I distance myself in crowded aisles or at the checkout counter. And, you know, I just follow those social distancing recommendations that the Departments of Public Health have advised us.
Our next caller is Daniel. Daniel, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, Congressman. This is Dan Bosley up in North Adams.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to, number one, as I was listening to the callers, if there are other small businesses that are on the line, there's also the WorkShare program in Massachusetts.
It's critical. That's a good, very good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to thank you for all the work that you've done. And I think that we realize that there are actually two crises, the first being the coronavirus, and the second one really is our economy, and bringing the economy back is going to be a long-term struggle, I think. where they meet is in our healthcare system, and given the large number of healthcare employees that are now quarantined or have taken themselves out because they've been exposed to the virus, and given the fact that there are far more people that are reaching out for healthcare these days, I think the problem of surprise medical billing is going to be even worse. And that impacts both the economy of the people that you're helping out and also of the healthcare industries. And I know that you've been a real strong supporter, including the binding arbitration. I'm just wondering if there's anything more that we can do to help.
Well, I think in this, in this next package, which is really better described as stimulus, as I noted, this was really more about relief at the moment and stabilization. The next phase likely will include stimulus, and I think that as part of the description of surprise billing that you've offered, I would like very much to include our bill. I think that it's been well met by medical professionals and consumer groups. In addition, I'm delighted that you mentioned work share. I should have brought that up in my comments because it's a, I think, again, it's a confidence builder for employers. We, at the federal level, would now allow, even though previously 26 states had done it, that we would allow the others to now include this provision. And work share simply works something like this. If employers will keep their employees on, even if they have to cut hours, we would make up the difference in terms of compensation. So I think that we're better off keeping people, again, with that infusion of a paycheck to make sure that as we get back to a normal economy, that the economy through recovery is prepared to take off. And that's part of the provision that we've developed. Surprise billing is a very important consumer issue. And binding arbitration, which I had some experience with in my younger days as mayor, remember the significance of binding arbitration always is that the parties find agreement largely because they know that the consequence of taking the chance might bring great detriment to what they originally proposed. So I think that binding arbitration is a good concept. And again, most medical professionals support the legislation that I've developed with the Ways and Means Committee, and it's been well met by consumer groups as well. So thanks, Dan, very much.
A reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 3. Our next question comes from William in North Adams. William, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. Congressman Neal and Dr. Letterman, I have two questions. One is for the doctor, and then one is for you. I think you already answered it, but I ain't positive. Doctor, I don't know if this sounds weird or not, but, like, you know, if you take your paper money, and if I put it in a nuke, I got a 900-watt nuke, and, like, I nuked it for, like, 30 seconds or 60 seconds, would that kill the germs?
Well, you know, I didn't think I was going to harken back to my old fellowship days, but when I was working with the strep throat germ, when I was in fellowship back in the, you know, in the early 90s, we used the microwave many times when we missed a run with our big steam sterilizer in sterilizing our glassware. We would put it in the microwave and zap it for a minute or two, and we never had any cross-contamination. So the microwave themselves does disrupt DNA and does disrupt, you know, microbial life. I just think you need to be very careful when you think about using a microwave in that capacity, because things can go in the microwave that don't belong. And if, you know, things like aluminum foil and you know, metal,
I wouldn't do any of that. I just put the paper bills in itself, you know. And should I, like, spread them out, or just, like, you know, just, like, do a little spread on them, or, you know?
I think if you already have these bills in your possession, it's probably too late. I would tell you, you know, if you're already touching them and managing it, I wouldn't worry so much about the what we call the fomite transmission, the particles that might get on your money. You know, I think what we know about the virus is that while it does live somewhat in the environment, you know, the more that it exists in the environment, the less viable it becomes, so that after 2 or 3 days, you know, particularly in a very dry environment, it may be that we would find most of the virus particles, if we were to detect them, to be dead. So I don't really know that you need to do that. But it is interesting, you know, that you ask. It is, you know, microwaves are one of the ways that we do use to, you know, to clear infection or, you know, take care of hazardous materials. Even in the hospital setting, we use large scale ones when we're getting rid of medical waste.
Right. All right. So I got nothing to lose by doing it anyways, then, right?
Well, you know, don't put your whole retirement in there at once.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. That I could do that real easy. Okay, thanks, Doc. Carnes and Neil, I think you answered the question, but I caught part of it because my dog had to go out and I had to let him out. I'm 78 years old. I'm retired on Social Security. And I don't pay any taxes because I don't make that much. I make, you know, a little under 15. Now, I heard that if you don't file, you ain't going to get nothing. I heard you're going to get something. But
that's not, yeah. If you're in the Social Security system, you're going to get something.
Okay, you don't know if it's the 12 or the 6 or...
I would assume. Yeah. I mean, I don't know your income. It phases out. That's a tax term. It phases out at $99,000. So I think that if you're inside of $75,000, you're in pretty good shape. And even then, it goes up to 99, but there's a bit of a phase out there. So I think based on the conversation, you qualify.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press *3 on your phone. Our next caller is Ben from Stockbridge. Ben, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Congressman Neil, it's Dr. Ben Lipson.
Hey,
for all
Ben.
You've done in this crisis.
Thank you, doctor. How are you?
I'm good. I have a question about the Postal Service. I read an article today that said they're going to run out of money by June, and we're not included in the first three rounds. Is there a chance that they will get some kind of support?
Yes.
I know the Republicans want to privatize the Postal Service, but...
Well, the challenge really was that it was, and I don't use this as a partisan pivot, but it was Senator McConnell who resisted that idea. We actually had a very simple proposal, and that was to allow the Postal Service to use the same retirement provisions that all other federal employees use, and they have to pay up front, and that's where that deficit comes from. And I think that that could be resolved fairly easily, but they certainly should be included in the second phase, the fourth phase of the next round of stimulus, for sure. I will just say I'm a big supporter and believer in the post office. I always have noted the following example, that it's those footsteps in the snow that those of us in New England come to appreciate, and they are almost like having another police force. They check on people. They know, particularly our senior citizens, who's well, who's unwell. And I would say that even in these difficult days, the dependability of those postal workers is something I think that we all need to acknowledge. That mail is delivered on time every day. Thank you, and I'm glad to hear from you, Dr. Lipson.
Our next caller is Meg from Pittsfield. Meg, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. This question is for Congressman Neal, and this is about an infrastructure question. There are large parts of Berkshire County who do not have access to broadband internet or solid cell service, and I'm wondering about all of the students who are trying to continue education, people who are able to work from home, trying to work from home. What do you understand as being your role as our representative and that of the federal government in addressing that infrastructure problem, especially if this continues for many months? Ranging from supporting municipal broadband, regulating internet as a public utility, or just helping people get access to what is an essential utility at this point?
Well, working with Governor Baker, we have extended broadband to many parts of the congressional district that did not have it before, but you're absolutely correct in your assessment. I see the expansion and extension of broadband as a national security issue, and I think that in an infrastructure bill, which I cannot believe that has not been done yet, I have been urging all the parties to find agreement. I think that should be part of recovery. I'm quoted in the New York Times this morning as to pushing the idea of a national infrastructure bill as part of recovery. And here's what I would include: highways, roadways, bridges, airports, rail, and sewer and water, and of course, as you've described it, broadband. I think it's an essential part of the learning component for young people, but it's also a national security issue for 911. So I think all of those components, as you've described them, are entirely correct. And I have had some luck with Governor Baker and others in successfully pursuing the expansion of broadband into parts of the Berkshires and in parts of Franklin County. And I also would say that even parts of Worcester County, there are some parts communities that don't have broadband access. And I think it's stunning that that doesn't exist. So this is another kind of just a philosophic point that I want to make. You will hear people frequently say when they talk about government intervention that the government overdoes it. Well, the point here is that every opportunity was given for private concerns to build out broadband. Instead, they found economically they could not earn a profit on it. That's the reason that it doesn't exist. So I think the government working with them makes a good deal of sense because it's an ongoing challenge, and I don't think the children ought to be in the library parking lot in the evening doing their homework from the car. So expanding broadband is very important. Good question, and thank you.
If you'd like to ask a question, simply press *3 on your phone. Our next question comes from Mark in Westfield. Mark, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Chairman Neal, thank you very much for your leadership and the straight talk that we're getting through these town hall meetings. My question is really directed to Dr. Lederer. We have heard from the New York Governor Cuomo, that we have to think a little different with respect to the coordination of medical and hospital services. And the question, I guess, is really the coordination with Berkshire Medical and BayState and, frankly, other hospital networks throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's been widely reported that we're perhaps maybe 2 weeks behind New York City with respect to any kind of peak that we could experience. And so the question is, are we ready? Are we getting the resources that we deserve and need with respect to the federal government? Because there have been reports that we're not getting what we need. So things like the ventilators and things like PPE, et cetera. And also, as a follow-along to that, are we using our technology to the utmost? For example, in Seattle, the use of telemedicine as a way of sort of working smarter, keeping people, from actually coming into public places. So that's the thrust of my question. Would appreciate your thoughts about that.
Sure. Let me tackle the technology aspect of that question first. Absolutely. Berkshire Health System and many others, because of some of the relaxation of rules, particularly when it comes to billing and documentation, we now are using telemedicine, either telephonic or video conferencing with our patients to better assess their needs, make determinations as to, you know, how can I manage someone who's just calling in for routine health maintenance? What prescriptions do they need? How are they doing? They don't need to take the risk of coming down, to a crowded medical practice and potentially being exposed. So, we know that that's very beneficial for them, whereas someone may call with respiratory complaints, and it's obvious just from viewing them on the screen that they need to come down and get attention. And, we want people who need our help to come and access that. So I've been very pleased with how telemedicine has evolved in this pandemic, and really I look for it to be kind of a game changer after the COVID experience is over. I think we'll see much more patient-centric, convenient access because of what we've built out in the telemedicine space. And for me, that's a game changer because I think it's giving patients what they've always wanted, which is more direct access, easier access, less complex in travel and less complex in just interaction. And so it's going to be a game changer, I think. And so I'm very pleased to see that. From the perspective of do we have what we need, clearly you read it in the New York Times, and it's something that we face every day. I mentioned earlier we don't have as many of the test kits that we would like to have so that we could test, patients at risk. We clearly, over the many prior potential pandemics, You know, we built out processes of care. We built out surge capacity. We had small stockpiles of some of the things we needed, but they just, you know, they sat there year over year, and we might use them periodically. We just don't have and didn't really, with these prior pandemics or risk of pandemics, you know, we didn't develop huge stockpiles. That was something that the national, you know, the federal government with the national stockpile did. And so we're looking for the federal government to release those national stockpiles to us. It's one thing to release several boxes or cartons or pallets of masks. It's another to say that, you know, in New York City, they thought they needed 30,000 ventilators. Well, I'm not sure that in Pittsfield we need 30,000 ventilators, but, you know, theoretically we could use 30. Our normal, you know, ventilation needs are somewhere in the, you know, the low 10 to 15 patients perhaps. And if we took, a doubling more again of that for the surge, you know, a 200 or 300% increase, you know, we need more ventilators, and they're just not available right now. You know, people don't build a $50,000 machine and then put it in a warehouse and hope to sell it. They really are, the supply chain for healthcare is a just-in-time manufacturing supply chain, so that there's not a lot of inventory to be had out there. So we're really looking for what Ford and GM and Dyson and others are doing in helping the federal government meet these needs. But if we're looking at a surge in the next 2 to 3 weeks, I'm not sure that this new supply chain of ventilators will be there available for us. So, you know, that's been part of our planning, is to understand that, you know, we're on our own in large part. We have the Department of Public Health. We have collegial relationships with Bay State and Albany. You know, we potentially have the ability to work with one another, particularly if one has capacity and one doesn't. But at the end of the day, you know, we've had to build out our potential for negative pressure rooms. You know, we're looking at ways that we can maximize our ventilators. We know that, you know, there are some across our system in North Adams and in Fairview. You know, there are anesthesia machines. Since we're no longer doing the number of elective surgeries, maybe we can repurpose those anesthesia machines into ventilators. So we're planning. And we're hopeful that the federal government and its planning, you know, will come to be a support to us and an aid to us, or that the national stockpile with the ventilators that are there on hand can be, you know, distributed to, you know, Western Massachusetts. Now, I would just say that, you know, I think Western Massachusetts has unique needs that aren't necessarily realized when you compare it against the Boston, where, you know, it's a very dense city. There's a lot of people there. It's an understanding of what those needs may be. But, you know, our residents, our communities have the same needs. You know, it may not be the same numbers, but it's still the same needs.
And you should know, Mark, that I raised that issue with Governor Baker in a conversation just a few days ago. And I noticed today that there are 4,000 new ventilators that are on their way. And I certainly, when we talk to Mary Lou Sutters later on, about the Holyoke Soldiers Home, that I intend to raise that issue as well. And the other piece of good news, I thought, from the infusion, again, of federal dollars in the stabilization package is a considerable amount of new money for the whole idea of telemedicine. So thank you.
Our next caller is Jim from Otis. Jim, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, we have had a live case of COVID in this small town. We're South County and fairly isolated, and we wonder where in this area can one go for testing, if necessary? And also, can we get access to testing without having a local doctor, because we don't have one?
I would tell you that your best option is probably to call the BMC Link line, the 800 number, BMC Link, and speak with the call staff there, and they can help advise. And if need be, we have clinicians, physicians who also staff that call center, and you could have a live conference or video with them. And you know, if you're again, we want to make sure that we use the test appropriately because we have so few. But if you're having symptoms and fever and there's concern, then that's probably your best access to healthcare testing in this area.
Our next caller is Claire from Springfield. Claire, you're live on the line.
Yes, hello. My question is for the congressman. My husband is 86 years old, and he's a resident of the Holyoke Soldiers Home. We've been seeing a lot of news, but not getting any answers at all. He is also at high risk. He is a dialysis patient who goes out of the home three times a week for dialysis. I've called the home and gotten no answers. They're on just a voicemail. Can you tell me how we can be, you know, get some information? We're held in the dark. We don't know whether he's
been tested. What I'm going to suggest, Claire, is that you leave a phone number with my staff here so that we can try to find out that information for you, and we'll call you back. You should know I have an uncle at the soldier's home as well. So we've been paying a lot of attention to it, largely because as the story broke over the last couple of days, we're trying to get additional information, and that's the phone call I have coming up with Mary Lou Sutters this afternoon. That's been prearranged. The Soldiers' Home, it's an interesting concept because it's technically a state agency. So the state's in charge of the Soldiers' Home, but I've been pretty helpful to it over the years with the assistance of federal support and money that was earmarked for windows and air conditioning and maintenance on the facility. So we're as anxious as you are to get that information. In talking to some of the nurses from the Soldiers' Home this morning, they gave me some idea of where it started, and they did suggest that the testing is going on right now, that we all want to make sure that happens, and I know that the Guard is helping out as well. But I'm going to encourage you to just stay with us afterwards so that we can get a phone number from you, and we'll check out and see what information we can get back to you.
Our next caller is Dave from Goshen. Dave, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairman Neal. This is Dave Christopoulos, Director of Hilltown CDC.
Oh, sure. How are you, Dave? Nice to see you.
Nice to talk to you, Randy.
Yeah.
You too. Thanks for doing this. I have a couple, two quick things I wanted to just mention to you to put on your radar, and then I have a question, healthcare question for the doctor. First, for Chairman Neal, one of the things I just wanted to mention to you, we're involved in affordable housing and helping low-income tenants, and one of the federal programs that has been kind of bouncing around lately is the low-income housing tax credit, LIHTC program.
Yep.
And I think that as this thing progresses, there's going to be a lot of hardship for low-income tenants. And for those of us who are developing housing, some of us are in the middle of projects right now, it's going to be critical that LIHTC program has an infusion of funds. The other thing that I wanted to just mention, maybe your staff could take a look at for a lot of us in our small businesses. I don't believe it's live yet, but the payroll protection feature of the relief bill is going to be something that a lot of small businesses are going to need to look at. And it's a complicated rollout, so maybe we can contact your staff if we have questions about that.
By all means, we'll make sure that that happens. We've got technical support staff, and I'm glad you mentioned the low-income housing tax credit. As you know, in the tax bill of 2017 in December, it was almost eliminated.
I know.
And if people wonder why it's important that you have somebody in leadership that understands that issue, I was able to save that credit, as well as new markets tax credits. And I feel very strongly about those initiatives. And in addition, you can be sure of this, it's not going to be altered as long as I am the chairman. It's a very important component of a very complicated process called how you generate units. So I'm very interested in that.
Great. I was eager to get on this call because I know in your position right now, you're critical to that. Thank you so much for that. And we probably will follow up with you through our association.
And I'll make it a point, if you want to call me, I'll put you in contact personally with an individual on the tax staff who can get your concerns.
Great, I'll arrange that. Thank you so much. My question for the doctor is, one of the things that we're really struggling with here up in the Hilltowns is getting food to people, particularly our most vulnerable seniors, who many of them are housebound and widowed. So there's a group of us who have the ability to do some food delivery. It's very difficult for us to logistically figure it out. My question is, do you have any advice for us in terms of handling food, how the COVID virus is interacting with food, and are there certain precautions that we could take that we may not be thinking of?
Well, I think, I mean, the risk to you from the food itself, if it's packaged, and we're not talking about, you know, maybe home-prepared foods being delivered, you know, by multiple individuals. If we're really talking about, you know, grocery-level distribution, you know, I would say that for those who are delivering, simply, you know, following good social distancing. So, you know, if possible, you know, if you can drop off the foods, you know, on the front porch and let someone know that it's there, and then they can come out and get it, then you don't have to worry about your risk, and they don't have to worry about their risk. I think obviously before starting your day and at any time along the way, you can't hand hygiene enough. To have a little bottle of some hand sanitizer with you so that you can, you know, hand sanitize after, you know, picking up the box and dropping it off and hand sanitizing when you get back in your car. You can't overuse that alcohol, and it won't absorb into your system and cause you any trouble. So, you know, I think the social distancing, the use of hand sanitizer, and you know, distributing grocery goods from, you know, from the store shouldn't be a risk to you per se.
Our next question comes from Ken in Pittsfield. Ken, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Hello, Congressman Neal. This is Ken Singer, President and CEO of Berkshire County ARC in Pittsfield. And we're a large nonprofit serving people with disabilities. We've had an outbreak, and we've had a number of positive people, at both individuals we serve and staff. We're very appreciative of everything the federal government has been doing. Unfortunately, many of these programs we are not eligible for, even though we're a nonprofit and we get most of our government funding, more funding from the government. Because we have more than 500 staff, we've been eliminated from all these programs. The sick leave bill, the new SBA bill, which is huge for loans, we're not eligible. Is there anything that can be done to address nonprofits?
Yeah, we didn't. I thought we included the nonprofits for the first time,
but not over 500 people.
Okay, so what I'm going to suggest is that we'll get some information. I will make sure somebody talks to you to see what else we can do in this legislation that we just passed, and see what we can do in the next round. Because I do think you raise a very important point about nonprofits, and I will follow up on that personally for you, and see if we can get you an answer as to how we might be able to utilize what we have, or next round what we might be able to do to help you out.
Our next question comes from Sue in Pittsfield. Sue, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, thank you, Congressman Neal and Dr. Lederer, for doing this. My question is regarding college loan debt. I have children and nieces and nephews at various stages of paying their loans and looking for work in this depressed job market. What is the plan to help relieve student loan debt during this crisis, and both for federal loans and private loans, and will it be consistent across lenders?
Yeah, what I want to do is, there is a provision there that was passed, and I think that there is some relief on the interest side of the payment. But again, I think the best way to get this is to get you a genuine and accurate answer that's fact-based. So if you hang on, we will get your name and number, and I will make sure somebody speaks to you about what's available, for sure.
Our next question comes from Donna in West Springfield. Donna, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for doing this. This is very helpful. I'm wondering how much money and research has been spent on finding out what will kill this virus before it even spreads to people. On a wide-scale basis?
Well, I before I defer to the doctor, which I intend to do on this, Dr. Lederer, I do want to say that when you have a chance to watch Dr. Fauci, he has been over the years the gold standard. He's been the North Star of the individuals that we've all followed, and his career has had an impeccable series of achievements. I also have great faith in the National Institutes of Health. These are treasures. They are funded by the federal government, and it's a good expenditure of the tax dollar. So waiting for the breakthrough, as I follow the research every day, I'm going to defer to Dr. Lederer on that.
So, I mean, it's the great question, and it's kind of the crux of how do we deal with things moving forward. And I would tell you that coronavirus itself is a known circulating virus that seasonally hits us every fall and winter, and we have a number of affected individuals. But the standard coronavirus is one of very minimal symptoms, upper respiratory tract. We're not seeing any of these major complications as we are with COVID-19. But it is to say that, this is what viruses do. They circulate in and amongst us. And as long as they're wimpy and don't really have any, great effect on us, well, they just go about their business and we kind of let them do that. But when we have something like the COVID-19 virus strain, now it gets our attention. And I think our best hope for prevention of COVID-19 will lay in the work that right now the researchers are doing in developing a vaccine. It's not a quick process, but it is one, as we do with the flu shot, year over year over year. If we see minor genetic variations in the flu, we adjust, our vaccine accordingly. And likewise, I think, we will take the same approach with the COVID-19 virus. Ultimately we'll have a good vaccine. And if this coronavirus is able to genetically modify itself and drift, then we'll tackle that year over year with an updated vaccine. And I think that's our great hope. There's nothing really environmentally that you can do to wipe this out of kind of our environment. It really is going to be, invigorate and bring the patient's immune system to bear and get everyone vaccinated and, have a prevention before you're ever infected.
Our next caller is Ben from Springfield. Ben, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Congressman. This is Ben Quick. How are you today?
Oh, good, Ben. How are you?
Great. Congressman, I run a nonprofit in Springfield, the Pioneer Valley Riverfront Club. We host a lot of events on the river here in Springfield. And like many other nonprofits, our payroll is what's going to determine whether we can weather this storm. So I reached out to my Small Business Administration about the payroll protection program, as a previous caller referred to. And they referred to me to my bank. And Berkshire Bank, they're a great bank. But the officers of Berkshire Bank have told me, Ben, we have no idea when we are going to receive protocols on distributing that stuff. So if there's information that's not getting to them, maybe you could help. Or if there's a time frame that we're looking at, that'd be great to know. Thank you.
I've been following, and by the way, I know this is a healthcare conversation, but the improvements in the Connecticut River have been one of the great achievements of my lifetime. And part of it was the CSOs that we were able to do, the combined sewer overflow money that we put into it. But the Connecticut River is in far better condition today. As a matter of fact, it still is a National Heritage River than it was 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 10 years ago. So I will look into this. I know that in conversations with Secretary Mnuchin, we know this is all about speed and getting this money through the system. Of using the community banks as the intermediary and using credit unions as the intermediary is very important to us, largely, again, because they know their customers. So it's a good point, and I will get after that personally in conversations with the Secretary.
Our next call comes from Lynn in Shelburne. Lynn, you're live on the line. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm going to speak to Congressman Neal here. Thank you for your opportunity for us to call you. I don't know if this has been covered or not, but I collect disability, and I get less than $13,000 a year. And I was just wondering if there's any kind of help that's going out to people on disability.
The quick answer is yes. Specific answer, I want to get accurate information for you. So, again, if we can get just your number and all that. But I believe in the SSA, we decided that was very important for coverage as well. So, I mean, the extension of that allocation of federal dollars. So I will get you a specific answer on that if you hang on and let us have your number.
Our next question comes from Joe in Coleraine. Joe, you are live on the line. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. This question is for the congressman. You've mentioned a couple of times in your comments about confidence in the economy, but I also think there needs to be confidence in the idea that we are, as a nation together, going to get through this issue. And you have to put these things in context. And I realize many, many people are dying and many people are infected, and et cetera. But as a percentage of the population, it's relatively low. And I am very disappointed that people on both sides of the aisle are playing politics with this epidemic. And, for example, back when the president instituted the travel ban to China, or from China, in late January, early February, he was widely criticized as a racist xenophobe, while simultaneously people were encouraging people in positions, such as the director of health for New York City, was encouraging people to go about their normal life and be in crowded places. And now we see what we have in New York. And just recently, yesterday, I saw an interview by Speaker Pelosi where she used the line, while the president fiddles, people are dying. None of this is helpful, and none of this is inspiring confidence. It's spreading fear. So I'm asking you, Congressman, what are you going to do to stop the people in your circle, including the speaker, from spreading fear and playing politics?
I think word choice is very important in this atmosphere. And I have calibrated my words, as you know, very carefully over the years. And I think that part of the term confidence means instilling a belief in people that the aspirational value of the conversation is really important. I think that what I chose to do is I helped develop that relief package that passed, and the first relief package of $8.3 billion, the second one, and now the third one. I am very proud of the fact that every Republican in the House, with the exception of one, voted for the bill that we largely put together on the Democratic side, but we included them. And that was true of the first two pieces of legislation as well. So I think at this time that what's very important is to make sure that the words that we use are accurate, that they are based on fact, and that we cannot mislead people about the conversation or the tone of the conversation. So I think that this is one of those moments where people rely upon information that flows from the federal government, but it really has to be accurate, it really has to be factual, and it cannot be changed from hour to hour. Thanks for the call.